Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the elections in Tunisia that could be a harbinger of democratic change as the Arab Spring bears fruit in a country where the revolution sweeping the Middle East began. Veteran BBC journalist Roger Hardy joins us. He has been a Middle East and Islamic Affairs analyst with the BBC's World Service for 20 years and is the author of The Muslim Revolt, A Journey Through Political Islam. As well as the regional implications, we will discuss the victory of the Islamists in Tunisia and whether they will keep their promise to respect the secular traditions of this comparatively liberal North African country. Then we will talk about our neighbor to the south, Mexico, the author of a new book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency, joins us. We will discuss the increasingly violent and grisly criminal insurgency that poses the greatest armed threat to Mexico since the 1910 revolution, an insurgency which so far has resulted in 40,000 murders south of the border in a failed war on drugs that is fueled by money and guns from the U.S. Joining us now is Roger Hardy, who has been a Middle East and Islamic Affairs analyst with the BBC World Service for the last 20 years. He is currently a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics and is the author of The Muslim Revolt, A Journey Through Political Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Hardy.
Thanks very much.
And the elections in Tunisia have yet to be decided. The country's Independent Election Commission, known by the acronym ISIE, for reasons I'm not entirely clear about, seem to be very slow with the count. But at this point, there are 81 seats out of the 217-seat Constituent Assembly have been decided, with Al Nahda, the moderate Islamist party, having won 35 seats. And then the Congress Party with 13, Arida Chabia with 10, Etta Katal with 9, and the Progressive Democratic Party with 4. And already apparently the centre-left party, Etta Katal, is in negotiations with the moderate Islamist Al Nahda Party, which has claimed more than 40% of the seats. So that's the latest information I have. Do you have anything more up to date than that?
That sounds right, and I think it shows that the Islamists have received more votes than anybody else, which is pretty much what we expected, but not a majority, and so they're having to form what they're calling a government of national unity, and hence the coalition talks that, as you say, seem to be already underway.
And the leader of the Islamist party, Al Nahda, Rashid Ghannouchi, this has got to be a huge victory for him, having returned after 22 years of exile and at this point winning 40% of the vote.
It's a great triumph for him. He's a former school teacher, and when he spent more than 20 years in exile in London, I, like many other journalists here, went to see him. I think there's not much doubt that his Islamist opinions have mellowed over the years, and I think it's for that reason that his party now is routinely described as a moderate Islamist party. Now, what does that mean? It means that they're putting the democratic aspect first and the Islamic aspect second. They want to be a democratic party for all Tunisians, but at the same time a party that respects the values of Islam, but at the same time they would be very quick to say those values include tolerance and they include women's rights. I think one of the big tests will be whether they can overcome the mistrust that a large number of middle-class Tunisians feel towards them.
Well, already there's talk from those very quarters, Roger Hardy, of a double discourse between the party line and the more radical rank and file, differences between the moderate discourse of the party's leaders and the more conservative party activists on the ground. It does seem that in the poor inner city and rural areas, the party did well.
I think that's the case, and I think it's at least possible that Ghannouchi is more progressive than some of his own party members. Large parties like this, even when they've had to exist underground for a large number of years, as they did under President Ben Ali, nevertheless are a kind of coalition between more moderate Islamists who are ready to live and let live with other Tunisians, and more radical Muslims who have a very conservative view of their religion and a very conservative view of women's rights, for example. So I think part of the test is whether Ghannouchi, who is now 70 years old, I mean, he's very well regarded, he's revered. Tunisians call him the Sheikh, which is revering his old age as well as his Islamic learning, but whether he can really show the leadership skills, the political bargaining skills, to keep the show on the road as they enter what is going to be, without doubt, a very difficult transition away from dictatorship towards something better.
Well, obviously, the big challenge is unemployment, which is pervasive with the young throughout the Arab world. Al-Nader's promised 590,000 new jobs over 5 years and to cut unemployment to 8.5%. I don't think even an American politician would make those kind of claims.
It's a very big promise, and I think that was very important for a lot of the voters, especially the younger voters. Youth unemployment is extremely high in Tunisia, as it is in many of these Arab countries, where people under 30 are 60, 70, sometimes even more than 70% of the population. So people wanted to believe that they're a democratic party. I think politics is the main driver here. But at the same time, if they get a government in that's more democratic, less corrupt, pledged to try and get rid of corruption and the kind of crony capitalism associated with the old regime, at the same time, they're going to have to show that they're technically competent, that they have the technocrats within their ranks who can bring about real economic change for a population whose expectations are extremely high. A lot of Tunisians, just like Egyptians further along the coast in Egypt, wanted to believe that once the dictator had gone, their lives would get better in some material sense. Now it hasn't. The economy has got worse in most of these countries. Tunisia, like Egypt, relies on tourism, and there's no way international tourists are going to come to a country that's going through a very turbulent political phase. So it's going to take a while to get some of those tourists back, and they may not come back in the same numbers that they were there before. So all of that amounts to a huge economic and social challenge for the new leaders of the country.
Well, of course, the Europeans themselves are not exactly out of the woods in terms of their economic health, and that would indicate probably a downturn in tourism, no matter what the destination might be. Again, I'm speaking with Roger Hardy, who has been a Middle East and Islamic Affairs analyst with the BBC World Service for the last 20 years. He is currently a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics and is the author of The Muslim Revolt, A Journey Through Political Islam. This election, of course, is, I think, the first democratic election in the Middle East, North Africa, Arab world, if you will. I guess the last one would be in 2006 in the Palestinian elections that brought Hamas into power and split the Palestinians. What about its significance? Obviously, we've just had a third Arab dictator removed from power next door in Libya. You've got a fourth stubbornly holding on to power in Yemen. and a fifth in Syria seems to prepare to continue to massacre his own people indefinitely as long as he can hold on to power. It's a pretty grim prognosis. How much is this hopeful sign going to change the dynamics, do you think, Roger Hardy?
I think the symbolic power of it is enormous. Tunisia already had the symbolic power of being the place where this all began back in December of last year when this young man, this market trader, set fire to himself as an act of protest and against the authorities. Now Tunisia has, as it were, the double acclaim, the double kudos of being the place that, where the first free election has happened since this Arab Spring got underway. Now, those things are symbolic, but at the same time, they will give, they will boost the morale of activists and democracy movements elsewhere. Now, to go back to your question, will it by itself change the dynamics of the region? No, I don't think so. And I think in some ways, Tunisia has always had, from the beginning of this whole affair, advantages that some of the other countries, including Egypt, by the way, do not have. The fact that it's small, that it has an educated population by the standards of the region, that it has a tradition of tolerance by the standards of the region, and even the fact that it is very close to Europe, just across the water, all those things, at least to a degree, act in its favor as they embark on this, what will undoubtedly be a very difficult transition in the months and years ahead. So the Tunisians are starting from a better place, I think, than Egypt, and a far better place than Libya, where there's also been regime change, as we all know, and now the death of Gaddafi. And if you compare Tunisia with this very grim situation in Syria and Yemen, the places where there is the most violence at the moment as regimes cling stubbornly to power, well, in that comparison, Tunisia is light years away. But this election, including, by the way, the fact that the Islamist party has done better than anybody else, will, I think, encourage a lot of people in Arab countries, regardless of the situation in those particular countries, to believe that if you go on protesting, even against a dictator who's ready to use a lot of violence against you, you can, in the end, achieve something.
And what about, Roger Hardy, though, the message of encouragement to other Islamist parties? We have the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, who have essentially, when the revolution started, it was largely started by the liberals who... essentially, the ruling military junta have tried to diminish their influence, make sort of secret deals with the Brotherhood, and you know, this violence against the cops has to some extent put the military on trial there. They don't seem to want to leave. But is there something to be learned from the Tunisian example, and that is that in these countries, in the with high unemployment and in the poor inner city and rural areas, people simply will vote for God. And that will likely happen in Libya, and it will likely happen in Egypt.
I think that's broadly true, but I think there are some differences which are of some importance. I think the leadership of the Egyptian a party, the Muslim Brotherhood, the leadership is more conservative than Ghannouchi in Tunisia. I think it's a crusty old reactionary leadership in Egypt, which frustrates some of the young Muslim activists who went to Tahrir Square and joined forces with the younger, more nationalistic, more secular folk with their mobile phones and their Facebook pages and so on. So I think that conservative leadership in the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is one distinct feature that they have. I think the other that's very important is that the military has played a different role in Egypt. In Tunisia, the key thing in getting rid of Ben Ali was when the military withdrew support for him and said, we're not going to kill Tunisians to keep you in power. And at that point, the military very largely withdrew from the scene. In Egypt, it was almost the opposite. The military intervened to end the standoff in Tahrir Square, that extraordinary dramatic period of days. And they were the ones who forced Mubarak out and brought the Tahrir Square protests to an end. Initially, Egyptian Democrats and activists welcomed this, but now they're very suspicious that the military simply wants to hang on, preserve its own power, even if there are elections later on, and there are due to be elections there in Egypt next month, but that the military somehow will engineer things to preserve their own power in the country and to preserve the very important perks and privileges which go with that power. So I'm not totally pessimistic about the Egyptian case, but I think the Tunisians have more going for them right now. I think they've got off to an earlier start than anybody else, and that conditions are on the whole more favorable in Tunisia than they are elsewhere.
Well, just in closing, Roger Hardy, there have apparently been reports that Islamist fundamentalists in Tunisia burned down at least 3 brothels after Ben Ali fell. And as you were saying earlier, this is Tunisia has a fairly secular and liberal tradition. It's more European than most of the Arab countries. Now, the Al Nahda has promised not to touch the Tunisian legal code, which outlaws polygamy, mandates women's approval to get married, limits the power of men in divorce, legalized abortion, etc. Pretty much unheard of anywhere else in the Arab world. Would that be a litmus test to watch?
Very much so. I think one of the problems for the Islamist party of Ghannouchi is that there are other Islamists, usually described as Salafis very close to the kind of Wahhabi Islam of Saudi Arabia. And it was probably them that have been attacking the cinemas when there was a film they didn't like, or attacking the brothels or places where alcohol is served. It is worth noting that Ghannouchi has condemned the use of violence. He's condemned intolerance when these incidents have taken place. But now is when the real test begins. First of all, the test of whether the Islamists can work in tandem with more secular nationalistic parties in a government of national unity. That's not going to be easy. And whether their actions will reassure that educated Tunisian middle class, as well as reassuring the country's Western allies. The guy's words are good. He talks the talk. But can they actually achieve the kind of national unity they're talking about? And can they solve the country's extremely pressing problems? The road ahead is going to be long. It's going to be rough.
Well, just a quick last thought, though. Won't this isolate Algeria even further, given the path of reform that's going on in Tunisia and next door in Libya, and the Algerian regime basically supported Gaddafi and his sons, and his family have taken refuge there. We know that they, after 20 years ago, they nullified an election where the Islamists won, and that led to decades of unbelievable brutality. What's your prognosis on the Arab Spring affecting Algeria?
Algeria, at least so far, has been the dog that didn't bark. It's true there were some protests in the early months of this year, but since then, very little. And this is, on the face of it, pretty surprising, because Algeria has all the problems that are very familiar in these Arab countries now. A young population, an unpopular and corrupt and authoritarian regime that's made up of both civilian and military elements. You'd have thought Algeria was ripe for protest and demonstration. I think the break on all of that is actually quite simple. The country went through hell in the 1990s for pretty much a decade, with violence between different armed Islamic groups and the security forces, a kind of dirty war in which everybody played the game in a dirty way. Huge numbers of Algerians were killed, anything between 100,000 and 200,000. Algerians look at one another and say, we're not going to risk going back to all of that again. And if we take to the streets again, even though we have plenty of grievances, we'll run the risk of a rerun of those terrible events. They just don't want to go there.
Well, I thank you for joining us here, Roger Hardy. It's been an interesting conversation. Again, I've been speaking with Roger Hardy, who has been a Middle East and Islamic Affairs analyst with the BBC World Service for the last 20 years. He is currently a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics and is author of The Muslim Revolt, A Journey Through Political Islam. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in studio is Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, the Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. He has covered military operations, mafia killings, and cocaine seizures, and has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. His new book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Grillo.
Thank you very much.
When you use the word insurgency, it suggests something fairly dire. Now, we had, towards the end of the Bush administration, some Pentagon official referring to the U.S.'s future security threats being two failed states, Pakistan and Mexico. And needless to say, that upset a lot of officials in Mexico. Where would you describe it in terms of either a failed state or a state undergoing an insurgency?
Yeah, these are certainly very controversial terms, and this has been a very hot debate about the language. One thing, in Mexico, it's such an extraordinary situation in terms of the violence and in terms of the type of conflict we've seen. And people struggle for words or language to even describe it. No one's really, really sure. What do you call this? What do you call a situation when you have a group of 50 armed men with Kalashnikov rifles and RPGs attacking a police station and they're working for a drug trafficker? What do you call it when you have 200 bodies in a series of pits? What do you call it when you have a militia massacring 72 migrants on their way to the United States? What do you call it when you have the head of the entire federal police murdered in his own household, coming home from from work and arriving there, and there's an assassin waiting for him. So I use the term criminal insurgency because in this situation, you have groups who have overwhelmed the power of government in many parts of the country. They are in armed rebellion against the military and police forces, and they are capturing parts of the state. In the parts of Mexico, they've become like a shadow government. When they take money from businesses, when they go to businesses and say, you have to pay us, and often they take money even from school teachers, they become like a form of predatory shadow government in these areas. Now, some businessmen in Ciudad Juarez at one point said, well, why should we pay tax to the federal government if we're paying off protection money to the drug cartel? They've become, you know, why do we have to pay tax twice? And they have quite a compelling argument. A newspaper in Ciudad Juarez called El Diario, when a reporter was murdered on his lunch break, a young man, a photographer, just beginning his career, was having a lunch break and was shot dead. And the newspaper wrote an editorial addressed to the cartels, but also really addressed to the government of Mexico, saying to the cartels, saying, you cartels are the de facto power in this city. What do you want from us? Tell us what you want. You know, even in a war, we have to have rules. Very powerful editorial. So I describe the term criminal insurgency to say, you know, this situation has gone way beyond organized crime. It's not just cops and robbers anymore. In the days of Al Capone, you know, the famous Valentine's Day massacre, I believe, was 7 people shot dead. In one massacre in Mexico, we've talked about 72 people.
I guess the two presidents you've sat down with have been Vicente Fox and Felipe Calderon.
Ernesto Zedillo.
And Zedillo as well. So
I know. Well, I haven't sat down with interviewed Calderon directly. Okay. I've interviewed Zedillo and Vicente Fox.
So if you were to interview the current president, obviously the questions, he has made a very inflammatory remark recently suggesting that if the PRI comes back to power, they'll make a deal with the drug cartels. Frankly, I think that's absolutely in the cards because that's the history of the PRI. And probably the Mexican people are so tired of this that they're likely to accede to that kind of deal with the devil.
It's a complicated issue, and sometimes the terms can be a bit deceiving. You know, what really was the pre-strategy towards organized crime? And it's not quite as simple as to say the PRI made a deal with organized crime, Felipe Calderon attacks organized crime. During the PRI, you had 71 years of government and you had a changing relationship with criminal gangs. Now, even in the United States, you have a certain modus operandi of dealing with organized crime and dealing with drug trafficking in this country. In this country, drugs are sold in every state. In this country, drugs move around the U.S. In this country, there's neighborhoods all over the nation where people are selling drugs on street corners. But Washington is not ordering military units into these neighborhoods to try and attack the drug trade. It's allowing the drug trade to function. And it's arresting certain traffickers and whatever. It's got a certain kind of modus operandi going on. Now, Felipe Calderon has had a rhetoric of war, of confrontation from when he took office. And has done very large symbolic actions from the beginning of sending the military into neighborhoods, of attacking. And this policy was not successful. Those who defend Calderon's record say it would have been worse still if he hadn't done it. No one says things have got better because things have so obviously gotten worse in the last 4 years. I mean, 40,000 murders, widespread extortion, civilians being hurt by this. The next government that comes in is, in my opinion, inevitably going to have a shift in strategy. Now, it's not, you know, you know, I don't think it's quite as simple as any government these days can just sit down in the presidential palace and say, you know, have the capos come to dinner and make a deal. But there can be a shift in strategy, and I think the PRI or whoever gets into power will shift strategy and say, we're going to move away from the confrontation of war and have some kind of allow, you know, being less confrontational about drug trafficking. And Calderon is, you know, obviously, you know, attacking the PRI right now for certain political reasons as well.
Again, I'm speaking with Joan Grillo, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for major international news organizations. And we're talking about the war on drugs next door in Mexico, chronicled in his new book, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. But my understanding is that much of the power of the cartels in terms of their political protection and their relationships with politicians comes at the state level. And the state of Guerrero, for example, has been run forever by the Figueroa family, these criminal caciques. And now, of course, it's been run by the PRD, but there's kind of a war going on there. So isn't that, you know, one of the governors down in, was it Tamaulipas or somewhere, disappeared, is on, you know, literally on the lam? Walk us through that. Is this just a federal problem in Mexico?
Sure. The issue with the local corruption, and like you say, there are a lot of what they call caciques, chiefs, in the old term, and Mexico has always been run by local strongmen. Part of the central reason for the violence right now is because under the PRI, the chiefs were all kind of controlled by their governors, who were controlled by the president. It was a system of power where the money bribes could flow up like gas and the exercise of power could go down like water, and things were held together. And part of that system of corruption was drug cartels and drug traffickers. With the change to democracy, this great change to democracy, the celebrations we saw from 2000, in the same way that right now in Egypt or Tunisia they're celebrating new democracy, we saw a fragmentation of the system of corruption. And we saw different political parties controlling different states and controlling different municipalities and different police forces. So we've seen a real breakdown now where you often have certain municipal presidents or state governors or state police forces or factions of these allied to specific drug cartels and sometimes actively fighting each other. So often we know we see the federal police going into an area. They go into a city, the first thing they do is arrest a bunch of the municipal police, the first people. So, yeah, we see a lot of conflict because of that.
Well, particularly in the state of Guerrero, surely.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been some really bloody incidents there. That would seem to probably be the outgoing caciques fighting the or destabilizing the PRD government that's in power, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think you have a lot of different local situations, like in Guerrero, right. Michoacán, Tamaulipas.
Well, there have been massacres
Durango.
In Acapulco hideous ones.
Yeah, I mean, Acapulco itself has got its own particular story of conflict. That Acapulco has always been an important place for the drug traffickers, an important place to move the drugs across that part of the Pacific, an important place for marijuana grown in the mountains around there, a place where drug traffickers like to buy nice big houses and to party there, an important place for its local drug market where people in nightclubs like to take cocaine or whatever. So you had a bunch of reasons, and because of the attacks on the drug cartels by the government of Felipe Calderon, you saw the power in Acapulco fragment. On one drug trafficker who was very powerful across Mexico was Arturo Beltran Leyva, the Barbas, or the Beard, this bearded trafficker from the hills of Sinaloa, who was very powerful in Acapulco. And when he was taken down, shot dead by Marines in the city of Cuernavaca in December 2009, his empire really fell apart. So you had a whole bunch of people fighting for power there, and Acapulco really has become a very bloody front in the war in Mexico.
So, Johan Guler, is it possible that these drug wars that have caused 40,000 casualties and have, as you describe in your new book, El Narco, that inside Mexico's criminal insurgency, you use that word that we're familiar with from Iraq. Is it possible that at some point or other, with this fratricide going on amongst drug gangs, that one drug gang will survive, there'll be a last man standing, and then the government will make a deal with that person? Is that where we're heading?
I think on a national level, it's very hard to have one single drug cartel. Mexico's a very big country. Right now, we can talk about seven different drug cartels. And to understand really what these cartels are, they're like federations. They're not like always a top-down company. When the work I've done in interviewing members of drug cartels, and when you look and break down other testimonies from inside, they're very much these kind of loose federations. But right now you have seven. I think it's very, very hard to have one last man standing. I think whenever you take down one big boss like Beltrán Leyva or Tony Tormenta or Nazario Moreno or various other bosses that have been shot dead in recent years, people just start moving in and fighting over their empires, fighting over their turfs. So it's only created more and more violence. Mm-hmm. And it's been impossible to take it all down like they took down Pablo Escobar in Colombia back in 1993.
But El Chapo Guzman seems to be a real survivor though, doesn't he?
El Chapo Guzman is an immensely powerful figure, and his name is immensely powerful mm-hmm. across Mexico. It's always very hard to know really how... no one knows how much money he really makes or how many men he really has under his command. His name has taken on a massively symbolic meaning. He's become, this mythological, powerful godfather. But then, even Chapo Guzman is not powerful, for example, in Tamaulipas state mm-hmm. so much. In other parts of the east, he's got still certain parts of Mexico where his dominance is much, much stronger.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the characters that you portray in your new book, Johan Grillo, El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. There's this character, Gonzalo, who you spent time with, and he, and we've heard of the Zetas, these former military and police officials, with their own cartel, a particularly violent one. But you point out that the path from a policeman to a criminal is alarmingly common in Mexico and mention a whole bunch of these people. And in the 1990s, traffickers flourished. In effect, what happened was the so-called victory in the war on drugs in Colombia freed up Mexico and made it. And isn't that happening in a kind of domino, grim kind of domino way? My understanding is Honduras is very, very much under the control of narcos and that Guatemala is, in fact, a criminal state.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've long talked in terms of the drug war about this balloon idea, that when you grab a part of the balloon, it inflates somewhere else. So when you grab the balloon in Colombia, it inflates in Mexico. If you put pressure on Mexico, it will go off in Guatemala. Because, you put pressure on Guatemala, it could go off in Honduras. But we've seen now this escalation and the way that the drug cartels have created increasingly violent militias. There's this path we've seen. Whereas back in the 1990s, a lot of the guys who were down in close by here in Tijuana, for example, were gangbangers they actually imported from the United States. People who grew up in ghettos in the United States, so of Mexican origin, were going to Mexico and work as hitmen. And they were gangbangers with shaved heads and tattoos using handguns. And these days, they're former Mexican special forces, former Guatemalan special forces working as mercenaries, people with RPGs, grenades, working like military units. So we've seen this incredible escalation, and it's kind of, right now, it's very bad across the hemisphere. I mean, yeah, Guatemala is being hit very hard. Honduras is being hit very hard. And it's a problem we really have to look at across the hemisphere. And this problem that we see in Mexico could well emerge in other countries. There's a lot of other countries also on a knife edge.
But this character that Gonzalo that you profile, who has become born again in the prisons, and you portray him as actually being genuinely seeking redemption. He's almost embodies the changes, because in his career as a drug, as a narco, he's seen these changes take place. And now, we're basically having heavily armed troops in urban warfare against rival gangs, mass kidnappings. He was controlling safe houses with dozens of victims bound and gagged. What's particularly grim, though, is the descriptions of beheading people. I mean, that's the part of it that is just almost incomprehensible. The level of barbarity and how the level of barbarity keeps being raised.
That's right. The kind of terror they've unleashed and the idea of beheading. I mean, beheading, it really grabs attention. I mean, somebody who's decapitated is no more dead than somebody who's shot dead and isn't decapitated. But
when they're decapitated, when they're alive,
sure.
That's pretty
It's very,
shocking.
Very powerful symbols sent out to people. And people wonder where the beheading came from. It began only in 2006. We first started seeing beheading in Mexico and then started expanding very rapidly across the country. And it may have been, the time people were watching Al-Qaeda videos, which were very popular to watch on the internet and so forth, and were shown on Mexican TV. Also, some of the Guatemalan mercenaries had committed decapitations in the civil war in that country to try and sow terror into villages who supported leftist guerrillas. I think what you see with the use of this kind of terror and to make sense of it is the drug cartel militias are thinking like armies trying to control territories. They're not thinking like regular people or just like even like regular criminals. They're thinking like armies trying to control territories. How do you control a territory? You sow terror. You stop the public, intervening with you. And you try and show to rivals you're the strongest team. If you leave a body of 12 corpses, you're also sending a message to the street that you're the force who's most to be feared in this area. So I think, to make sense of this, that's why we have to see this in terms of an armed conflict. And to find a way out of this, we have to say, how do you get out of an armed conflict? Is it through peace processes? We have to understand the extraordinary situation and that regular law enforcement isn't necessarily going to solve this thing.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Joan Grillo, the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And I'm continuing the conversation with Joan Grillo, who's here with me in the studio. He's the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. Well, isn't a part of the answer the fact that here we are in the United States pretending to be the piano player in the whorehouse? We're pretending that, all of this stuff is going on south of the border and it has nothing to do with us because we're a law-abiding society. But we are the customers for these drugs. It is American drug consumers' money that's fueling this war, not to mention the fact that high-powered weapons are readily available in gun stores in the border areas of the United States and are sold across the border and end up in killings of American drug enforcement agents. Now we're learning that just in Tuesday's New York Times, a front page story saying that now the U.S. law enforcement people are infiltrating Mexico and not even telling the Mexican law enforcement authorities that they are trying to infiltrate these gangs. So there's a massive level of distrust between the United States and Mexico, and there is this unbelievable attitude in the United States consistent with this illusory war on drugs that somehow this is Mexico's problem, not our problem, and that we will never, ever seriously talk about demand.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the question of American drug policy and a failed American drug policy has to be in the same debate as the discussion over the Mexican drug war. There's $30 billion, we believe, going every year from American consumers of crystal meth, marijuana, cocaine, and heroin to these cartels, and that money goes directly to pay for the assassins, for corrupting police forces, for corrupting politicians, for paying for safe houses and guns and ammunition, which also in a large part come from the United States. So yeah, we'll have to see how that plays out. There is a debate in this country about legalizing marijuana. There could be states legalizing marijuana in the coming years, and that will affect Mexican drug cartels. That will take away money from Mexican drug cartels and could be a very important factor in changing the situation in Mexico. About the use of the undercover informants or generally of the American prosecution policy against drug traffickers, the Mexicans are obviously very suspicious about the American tactics. The American tactics with trying to bust drug gangs have become very dirty in their nature. In the book, I profile an undercover agent of the DEA who infiltrated the Medellin cartel and another cartel in Mexico. And, you know, you see the way they work with paid informants. I mean, it's the logic of trying to bust drug traffickers. It's a very difficult game trying to bust drug traffickers. It inevitably leads to the kind of espionage that we've seen, which, when it comes out, starts creating a lot of tension between the countries.
So how has this affected you, Joan Grillo, again, the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency? You obviously spent a lot of time, and you say here, I've watched too many videos of the pain caused by killers like Gonzalo, this fellow that you profile. I've seen a sobbing teenager tortured on tape, sent to his family, a bloodied old man confessing that he had talked to a rival cartel, a line of kneeling victims with bags over their heads being shot in the brain one by one. I mean, this is just hideous even to think about, let alone to witness.
Well, certainly. I mean, like I mentioned then, watching a lot of this stuff on video, where this war has often been fought on video.
These are police videos that you've
seen. Often police videos. But then again, I think really, and we can talk about all of Mexico, the whole Mexican public has been very traumatized by these images and this situation in the last few years. I mean, you can, in fact, find a lot of these videos on the internet, and you can see they've got 2 million, 3 million, 4 million hits. There's a lot of very, you know, violent videos out there. Sometimes you get privy to police videos. Later, the police will release them to show how bad these criminals are and to show what they can do. But I think the Mexican public generally has been really traumatized by this. Obviously, it creates a lot of distrust in communities. It creates communities that are afraid to give any information about what they're doing, about, you know, even members of their family, about their business, about their income, because they're very scared about what could happen. So you've seen, you know, many people who have suffered from this. It's some difficult situation to deal with. And as journalists, it's our job to look at this, to understand this, and to make sense of what is going on in this country.
So, Joan Grillo, again, the author of El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. What is the answer here? Obviously, we don't have any answers here to our economic problems. We have a dysfunctional, broken government, and we're entering a political season. I don't know where Cencio, Calderon. Has he got left in his six-year term?
He's going to be out of power at the end of November 2012. The election's mm-hmm. July next year. There'll be a new president elected, and so yeah. It's kind of the next administration. I put the answers or the solutions in three areas. The first is in law enforcement. I think Mexico has more than 2,000 municipal police forces, 31 state police forces, plus the federal police, marines, army, and so forth. They're not only not working together, they're often actively fighting each other. Now, Felipe Calderon...
A lot of them are very penetrated, aren't they?
A lot of them are very corrupt. I mean, a lot of you have local police forces. You have local police forces as well, these small municipal police forces. In these towns, the drug cartel arrives and they're completely overwhelmed. They've got, you know, you have like police forces with like, you know, 20 guys with small guns and then 50 guys roll up with heavy arms. You know, what can they do against these guys? Mm-hmm. So they're overwhelmed.
But isn't there a fundamental choice that a decent, honest policeman in Mexico faces? And it's called plomo y plata, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Silver or lead. That's your choice. Yeah. You take a bribe or you take a bullet.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's exactly right.
Who the hell's going to, do the right thing under those conditions?
Yeah, exactly right. So basically, I mean, on this track, I agree with President Felipe Calderon. His proposal, he's tried to expand the federal police. It still has a long way to go. But he has a proposal, a bill in Congress to really reform the police forces and to start having unified single commands to get police forces wearing the same uniform and in the same structure and basically get rid of all the municipal police forces and start dealing with 31 state police forces, which are also in good coordination with the federal command. I think that may be the way forward. The future for Mexico has to really reform the police and create some decent institution, maybe modelled on the Colombian National Police Force, which has been effective. They've been very good about stopping kidnapping and that kind of thing. So that could be one way forward. The second policy area I think is very important is about helping the communities where drug cartel hitmen and traffickers are recruited from. I've done a lot of work in the barrios and the neighbors of Ciudad Juarez, where you find young men, teenagers, who start working for drug cartels, often for low wages. Now, a terrifying fact is that young men in Ciudad Juarez will commit a murder for 1,000 pesos, about $85. That is the price they will commit a murder today.
Now, is that an initiation kind of murder? In other words, how does it work?
It's the way they're recruited, and often they begin to be recruited when they're even younger, 14, 15 or younger. Often a drug cartel will come to them and say, look, if we give you a cell phone and we'll give you, you know, $50 a week or $30 a week in a cell phone, and just call us about what vehicles are going past. And then from there, they begin to, you know, get a gun and move up in the organization. But then some of these guys, they're not all millionaire traffickers. You find guys who are arrested and they're earning like things like, you know, they're on a payroll of like $500 a month and they're committing a whole bunch of murders for these guys. So like, how come the government or society can't compete with that? And you find that even throughout all of this conflict, nobody's doing any work in these neighborhoods. You know, even everyone's saying, or the government's saying, oh, we've got to help these neighborhoods, nothing gets up there. Now, there's some great social workers, independent social workers up there in these neighborhoods who work on this, and they get very little resources. And it doesn't take much. I mean, if a kid is prepared to commit a murder for $100, it shows what a desperate kind of life he's got. It doesn't take much, a bit of input, a bit of investment in them and their future to give them some kind of possibility in life. And, you know, America has given $1.6 billion in the murder initiative in the form of Black Hawk helicopters and guns, which has, you know, helped intensify the conflict in some ways. And, a few million dollars to these communities could perhaps really help them. And in the last area of policy, I think we have to look at drug policy reform. We'll see how that plays out in a few years, but that as well could help ease the situation and help less money go to drug cartels.
What's extraordinary, though, when you talk about Ciudad Juarez right there on the U.S. border, is the kid that kills somebody for $80 so that the shot can be heard in the United States. I mean, it's that close. Yeah. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, you sit in these neighborhoods and you watch American TV. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a place in some ways between, you know, two countries, between two worlds. Many of the families of these people have come from the countryside. They've broken their family roots. you know, the whole community where they used to live with the grandparents around and the great-grandparents and aunts and uncles, to a more alien environment where they have American TV, have this consumer culture, and have the American guns flooding into these communities.
Mm. So just to, finally then, Johan Griller, if you have the U.S., you know, with this failed war on drugs that's been metastasized into this vast bureaucracy, and it's like the gun lobby or what, or the military-industrial complex, whatever it is, there's nothing you can do about it, realistically. You know, there's too many rice bowls involved. There's too many paychecks involved. There's too much vested interest to show any imagination. But, you know, is the only sense being spoken comes tends to come from the south of the border, the countries that are actually dealing with the problems created by our demand here in the United States for drugs. So is there anything in that you think will ever happen in terms of you know, breaking through this kind of rigid, you know, I mean, it fits Einstein's definition of insanity. If you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome, then that is the definition of insanity. And that's the way I see it.
Well, things could definitely change. I mean, like you said, many of the presidents south of the border, the ex-presidents, are now coming out and saying, you know, not just Vicente Fox, Ernesto Zedillo as well, the ex-president of Colombia, Cesar Gaviria, Cardoso, the ex-president of Brazil, who came out and from their experience in power said, well, you know, we oversaw administrations trying to fight drug gangs and we think it's an insurmountable task. If these gangsters keep on getting money from selling to consumers, they're going to keep on fighting. And we have to look at change here. They're beginning, you know, to raise their voice. We need obviously active presidents to make their voice heard on this, to maybe see policy change more effectively. People tend to be very scared to talk about this when they're in power because of the political consequences. When they get out of power, they start talking. But in terms of U.S. drug policy, I mean, that's obviously a debate that has to happen here in the United States, has to happen in Europe, has to happen at the United Nations. But I think there is movement in this debate, and I think things can change. I don't, you know, say this is a non-starter. I think it's now becoming a debate that's being more and more open. I think a debate we definitely need to have in connection with the bloodshed going on in Mexico right now.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us in the studio today, Johan Griller.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Johan Griller, who has covered Latin America since 2001 for international media, including Time Magazine, CNN, the Associated Press, PBS NewsHour, Houston Chronicle, CBC, and the Sunday Telegraph. And he has discussed the drug war with two Mexican presidents, three attorney generals, and the U.S. ambassador. And his new book is El Narco, Inside Mexico's Criminal Insurgency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Headline written down.